All right, somebody want to stand and quote my memory verse for me, the Psalm 33. Brother Jeffries. Very good. All right, that's the verse that we're using. Now, next week I'm going to call on somebody else, so you better make sure you got it memorized. How many of you do not have it memorized yet? Okay, keep them up just for a second. Okay. I just wanted you to know, Miss Folk, next Sunday I'm going to call on somebody that had their hand up there that didn't know the verse the first time I asked. All right, in American history, we have come through the settling of the original colony, the Plymouth Colony, as well as the Massachusetts Bay Colony. We've discussed the differences doctrinally between the Puritans and the Pilgrims, and then we have discussed the influence that they had one on the other, and certainly they did influence one another. And again, let me emphasize, because we forget it, and if we don't remember this, then we really miss the blessing of the miracle of America. And that is, there was no government like America by which they could, by comparison, set up their government here. There was nothing like America anywhere. Every country that was in existence, every mighty country anyway, every country that they could have used as an example for a governmental structure had a church-state system. A system where the government was run by the church, or vice versa, the church was run by the government. You paid your tax dollars, and your tax dollars supported the church, and the clergymen ran the government, and that type of thing. It is unique that you have in America what you have. And I keep emphasizing that because I don't want you to forget that when our forefathers set up our governmental structure here, they did so without any previous example to follow. That's even more important when you look back from the vantage point of today, when we're told that the men that founded our government, of course, were not nearly as biblically oriented as we might think that they were nothing but deists, and they believed in the separation of church and state just like we believe it today. And that is an absolute provable lie. We will prove that as we go through, but the important thing for you to remember is that they didn't have a previous example. They didn't have a place where they could look and say, well, let's have democracy like they have in this country. They didn't have a place like that. They didn't have an example of a three-house or a three-division of government with the executive and the legislative and the judicial. They didn't have anything like that. When our governmental structure was established in 1776 through 1789, it was done so completely and purely without any previous example whatsoever. The men that were followed, their writings, men like John Locke, who wrote previous to the establishment of our government, all argued for the separation of a church and state, or for religious liberty, or for several other ideals that were eventually incorporated into our government structure, but none of them with any examples. When John Locke wrote for the separation of church and state, he couldn't say, do it like these people do it, because nobody had done it. And so all they did, even the writers of that period, they knew there had to be something better. As they read the Word of God and examined the Word of God, they saw the relationship that Christ had with the church. And as they did, they said that the example or the relationship between Christ and the church should be the way that a government has a relationship with its people. Not that the church should run the government, but that the church and its relationship with Christ is an example of how a good government ought to operate in relationship to its people. And so those ideals are being formulated during the century prior to the Revolutionary War. And we've come up through those colonies and we began to look at what happened when people began to pray and began to trust the Lord and began to seek the Lord's favor in their colonies. We looked at the division of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and we saw there, first of all, a fellow by the name of Roger Williams, who basically was kind of goofy, all right, for lack of a better term. And Williams ended up settling the colony, which is now Rhode Island. He also was Baptist toward the end of his life and espoused the teachings of the Baptists. I want you to realize also at this point that whether it be Puritan, Pilgrim, Baptist, most of those all preached and teach the same thing. For instance, the difference between a Baptist and even in most cases a Presbyterian at this point in time was kind of the difference between a Baptist and a Charismatic today. Okay, we have doctrinal differences with the Charismatics, but they believe in being saved like we do. And so there, although there were differences between the colonies, they basically were all preaching Jesus Christ, and they wanted to see people converted. And so there were not a great number of differences between those different religions represented here. However, when God began to prosper these people, and the colonies began to prosper, and they did. I mentioned the fact that what at one time might have been a 3-acre estate for an early pilgrim or Puritan settler now became 300 acres. Having one cow, an old milk cow at one time, would have been a tremendous blessing. And now they were beginning to have 50 and 60 head. And they, rather than just a little cracker box house, now they were beginning to build a finer home. And prosperity began to find its way to these people. Remember, every time people seek the Lord, prosperity will be the end result. And I don't care what that is. I'm not preaching a get-rich-quick doctrine. I'm not preaching, financial wealthy if you trust the Lord and serve the Lord. But I do know this. Every time you find a nation that seeks the Lord, that nation prospers as a result of seeking the Lord. America began to prosper. And sad to say, on the heels of prosperity come what we find in America. And that is people forget God. They turn away from God. If you read through the book of Judges, we call Judges the cycles of sin, because the period of the Judges in the history of Israel was the time when Israel would be right with God and God would bless them. They would become prosperous. When they would become prosperous, they would forget God and turn away from God. When they turned away from God, God would judge them, and they would find themselves oftentimes even in captivity with another nation. And when they would go into captivity, they would again turn to God. And God would raise up a deliverer who would give them freedom. And you'll find that cycle there is completed 12 times in the book of Judges, where they started out well. And yet by the time things are done, they're in captivity, crying out unto God. God brings them back to the top, and they go around the cycle again 12 times. You say, you think they'd learn. You think America would learn. You think as many times as we've been down the route of prosperity, only to have it interrupted by civil war or world war or things like that, you'd think America would learn, and yet we have not learned. And today, we're right at the bottom of that cycle of sin. We're right at the bottom where America is fixing to go captive again. It's lost its power with God. It's lost its ability to have God intervene in its affairs. Basically, God's left America on its own again. And so it's important for us to see what took place in the lives of these early settlers, because it's fixing to take place again. And these people began to prosper, and they began to grow in numbers. The colonies began to increase. Other cities were settled. And again, realize that, you know, at this time, a large city, might be 200-300 people. So we're not talking booming metropolises by any stretch of the imagination. People began to move out into the suburbs or out into the country. Whereas as a colony was first established, there might be 7 homes in an area the size of this building. Now they had begun to spread out, and they had begun to enjoy some of this prosperity, and they forgot God. I read to you the quote, I'll not read it again this morning, that I believe the Governor Bradford made concerning the pilgrims down in the Plymouth colony, how that now there was a generation that did really not know what it was to settle the colony. They did not know what it was to depend on God. They had no idea what it meant to trust in the Lord and to have to pray for your actual survival. And he talked about, with a grieving heart, the sadness that in less than a generation those people had forgotten God. Those were the pilgrims. And so that was the condition. And God's always got a way of stirring up God's people. And God, in this instance, is going to use the Indian tribes. And of course, the Indians, and there were hundreds of tribes along the eastern seaboard of the nation. Oftentimes, when we think of the Wild West, we think of, you know, out in Colorado and Texas and Oklahoma. Colorado, Texas, and Oklahoma never saw nearly as many of the Indian uprisings as Ohio and Kentucky and Pennsylvania and western New York saw. The real bloodbath occurred right in that area right here. And you probably from Toledo here, if you were to trace a line, draw a circle, I guess, with about a 100-mile radius, you wouldn't believe how many Indian tribes you would have come in contact with back in the 1700s. Just oodles of them, if I can use that terminology. They lived in this area. And they had been, for the most part, peaceful to the white man. They had kind of coexisted. And the matter of fact, the white man had sought to win them to God. There had been a great number of revival preachers, or at least missionaries, that had gone to deal with the Indians. And a lot of them had been converted. A lot of them had been saved. Massasoit, of course, had signed a peace treaty with the Pilgrims. And that treaty remained uncontested for over 40 years from the time the colony was settled. There was no incidents where anybody had raised a tomahawk or a musket in war. The Indians and the white man had gotten along. However, as the white man began to forget God, he began to truly mistreat the Indians. And I'll be honest with you, this morning our world talks a lot about injustice and inequality and all of this. And the problem with that is you can't cure injustice with force. You can't cure injustice with another injustice. The only way you can cure injustice is to have God's people right with God. And when God's people are right with God, they don't mistreat other people. That be said, if you study the history of the American Indian, you find every time a good Christian came in contact with the American Indian, he never mistreated them. But boy, you let somebody hungry for money or gold or fur or whatever it was come in contact, and they eventually destroy the Indian. By the way, it was the firewater that destroyed the Indian. And good Christians don't believe in fire water. Amen? So you have to watch that. The cure for America today, honestly, is the Lord Jesus Christ. It has never been the government. And the government has always, underline that, government has always been the enemy of the people. You need to write that down and remember it, because in this day and time, too many people believe government is their big friend. Government is Big Brother. Always has been, always will be, and government always has been the enemy of democracy, and this day is no different. And the reason people turn to government is because they can't control themselves. When we can't control ourselves, we turn to someone else and have them do it for us. Hence, government grows larger and larger and larger, while God's people grow more and more wicked and worldly. And that's the situation we find ourselves in today. But son of Massasoit, his name was Metacomet, and he was the son of Massasoit. His Christian name was Philip. It's kind of unusual to run into an Indian by the name of Philip, but that nonetheless was his name. And he was king now of the Wampanoag tribe from which Massasoit had made the peace treaty with the Pilgrims. And Philip did not like the white man. I have no idea as to what the reason was. Perhaps he'd been mistreated. I do not know. Perhaps he saw his power diminishing. Perhaps he just was power hungry, having been elected a new chief of a tribe. But to the credit of the Pilgrims, the internal strife among the Indian tribes kept the Indians from ever massing for a great revolt or an attack. In other words, with all these various tribes involved, you never could get the tribes together long enough to mass a great revolt. That's what you're seeing in South Africa right now, is the fact that there is not, it's not just black and whites. People say, well, it should be the majority. The blacks are not in the majority in South Africa. I don't know how many of you knew that, how many of you were aware of that or not. Not when you divide them according to their tribal breakdowns. You just haven't been taught that, have you? The whites are in a majority when you deal with the tribal breakdowns of those cultures over there. And you take the Zulus and the other tribal peoples that are there and break those down according to their tribal elements, and you don't have blacks in power anymore, blacks in control. And what you're beginning to see now is somebody has gone over there and has basically united all of these black tribes. And his name is Wilson Mandela. And Mandela is a professing, proclaiming communist. And what you're seeing in South Africa now is not the overthrow of a white aristocracy that has suppressed people. What you're seeing now is a communist takeover of South Africa. If you don't believe that, wait and see the bloodbath that's going to happen after these elections. You know, you'd think if the blacks are in control, once the blacks got the government, there wouldn't be a bloodbath. I mean, just wait and see what's going to take place, all right? And I'm not prophesying, but if history is true, whenever you can isolate various strands and pull them together for a revolt, they never stay united. They always splinter again. And I'm going to tell you what right now, the Zulus have had a reputation for the last 500 or 600 years of being the most ferocious warrior on the face of the earth. And you just wait till they turn loose again here pretty quick. The Indians begin to get together, and Philip begins to pull his strings and pull the other tribes together and begins to preach to the other tribes the fact that we have a common enemy. And they begin to pull together their forces. The pilgrims, or the colonists, or the settlers, I guess, for lack of a better term, are oblivious to all this. They're enjoying their property. They're enjoying their new life. They're enjoying this new world. They're beginning to raise families, and husbands and wives are beginning to have children and beginning to raise great numbers in their families again. It's not unusual to have a family with 14 or 15 people in it at this time, because it's a wide open range. It's a wide open territory, and America is here for the families to take. And so they begin to prosper, and as they do, the Indians begin to conspire. And in 1639, I'll give you an example of how oblivious most of the pilgrims were. Winthrop wrote about this later on in his history, gave an account of it. But at 1639 in Kennebec, the Indians were hungry. They had no food, and they had were without food, and they knew that the Plymouth colony had plenty of food in storage. And so they massed a plan by which they were going to come in and kill the settlers and take the food. And they spent days putting this plan together, how it was going to work and how it was going to operate. And one of the first things they were going to do is send a small scouting party into the village to meet with one of the fellows that was friendly to them. And they were going to set them up. And Winthrop told how these Indians made their way into the colony and knocked on the door. I can't think of the guy's name right now. I didn't write it down. But they knocked on this guy's door, and they were invited into his home. And this man had been involved deeply in the Bible study that morning. And because of that, he was very sober-minded. He was very serious. He didn't joke with the Indians. He didn't laugh with the Indians like normally the colonists would do. He sat there very sober-minded, and the Indians suspected something, because he always was very friendly toward them. He always would laugh and joke with them. He always was wanting to give them little gifts and trinkets and trade with them. Not so today, but he was very sober-minded. His eyes were filled with tears. And as these Indians left, they went back to the tribal people who were waiting on the outskirts of the village to attack the Plymouth colony, and they told them this. They said, "We have been discovered. They know our plan, and they're waiting for us." That's the reason he didn't smile and joke around today. That's the reason he wasn't friendly toward us. They have heard about our plan. And the chief of the Indians said, "How in the world could they have found out?" There's no way that they could have found out. The Indians told their chief this: "That man has a book, and that book told him that we were going to attack." And they didn't find that out until years later, when the Indians confessed to those settlers that is exactly what had happened. Winthrop recorded that in his history. But they said, "Those pilgrims, they have a book, and that book's telling them that we're going to attack." And the plan went up in smoke. Didn't last. But the Indians began to conspire. They began to pull together. And they began to assimilate their forces. And the thing that kind of pushed things over the edge was the murder of a fellow by the name of John Sassanon. John Sassanon was an Indian. And he had become a friend. He was a Christian. He had become a friend of the pilgrims and of the settlers. And he got word of King Philip's plans to pull together a great uprising. And he went to the leaders of the colonies and instructed them and said, "Listen, you had better take warning, because these Indians are about to attack. They are about to come after the settlers, and if you don't do something to stop it, there's going to be a great number of people who are going to lose their lives." Well, the governors and rulers of the colonies, they didn't put a lot of stock in what John Sassanon had told them. Even though he was a Christian, they never trusted an Indian. And they believed he was just telling them some stories in order to get some trading rights and privileges with them. So they didn't pay much attention to him until he was found dead not long after that. He was found dead and actually found him floating under the ice in a lake. And the Indians told them that he had fallen through the ice, but Indians don't fall through ice. Indians know more about living in the outdoors than you and I did or do. But they began to question that, and they broke open the ice and took his body from the ice. They didn't find any water in his lungs, which would indicate that he drowned. And they also found that his neck had been broken, which was not an injury you would sustain falling through the ice. And so they began to try and figure out what had happened to John Sassanon. And as they began to question people, there was an eyewitness that came forward, another Indian, and he identified three Indians as having been the murderers of John Sassanon. And he identified those three Indians, and one of them happened to be a right-hand man to King Philip, who was the Indian tribal leader. In order to be fair, the Indians were put on trial. And in order to be fair, two juries were selected. One, a jury made up of the settlers. The second jury made up entirely of Indians. And the case went to trial. When the trial was ended, both juries found all three individuals guilty of murder and sentenced them to be hanged. And they took them out. It was kind of interesting note. They took them out to hang them. And of course, they were all professing their innocence. They said they didn't do anything. And they began to hang them. And when they came to the third fella and the trap door sprung open, the rope broke. And he fell to the ground, startled but very much alive, so startled that when he got up, he confessed everything because he didn't want to die, you know, with his life not right with the Lord. He began confessing everything. He told exactly how they had killed John Sassanon, and so they strung him up again and killed him. But this irritated Philip. It was all he was looking for was some way to stir his people up and get them united. And he began to use this death of these three Indians to unite the Indian tribes. And it was not long after that the Indian uprising began in earnest. Let me give you some of the cities where you'll find the Indian uprising was taking place. It began at Swanesea in Plymouth, and the Indians began by attacking there. They then went to Dartmouth, then they went to Taunton, then they went to Middleborough, then they went to Sudbury and Lancaster, Groton, and Marlborough. Those are just names of towns. But realize, in every one of these towns, there lived somewhere between 50 and 500 settlers, and in most cases, the Indians would virtually destroy the village and kill everybody that they could get a hold of. And as was their tribal custom, when they were at war with the white man, they, I mean, just were brutal in the way they inflicted death, torture, and punishment. And I said before, it was the French that taught the Indians how to scalp, but many other things they knew by just course of living. They were very brutal people. And if you ever read a book, there's a book called The Frontiersman. It's not a Christian book, but it's a book written by Simon Kenton, or about Simon Kenton, who was one of the first settlers of the Ohio River Valley and actually came up the Miami River and then the Maumee River right up into this area here. And Simon Kenton described for you some of the ways Indians would inflict pain upon those that they captured. And just for an example, they'd take and cut the eyelids off an individual and set them in front of a fire, where you couldn't help but look at the fire, and you couldn't have any water on your eyes, and your eyes would literally bake out of your head and drive you insane. That's just one of many ways that the Indians had of inflicting torture on their peoples. And realize this, we hear a lot of things about the white man and his mistreatment of the Indians, and I'm not trying to downplay that, because as I said before, a bunch of wicked men, by the way, it was government that killed the Indians. Need to always remember that. Government always has been the enemy of democracy and freedom. And it was the government that killed the Indians. It was the government troops that marched on the Indians and slaughtered them wholesale. And however, the Indians were brutal in their own right. These Indians had been worshiping spirits and gods and demons for years. They were not any different than what we would find today, perhaps in New Guinea. They were not any different than what we would find around the world. People running around half naked, worshiping other gods and goddesses, feeding their own young to appease the wrath of their gods, killing their own people to satisfy the desires of other gods and goddesses that they worship. They were not a great deal different than any of those tribes. And for better or worse, one thing that the Indians got from the white man was the gospel. And a number of them got saved. And although they were mistreated, as I said before, by and large by the white man, realize this too, that the white man was attacked savagely by the Indians. And you have accounts of Pennsylvania and even into eastern Ohio and even as far over as western New York, where Indians would, marauding Indians would attack villages and steal wives and children and take them off into the woods and club individuals to death, skin people alive. All of those things were not just stories told out of storybooks and fairy tales. The Indians were a very brutal people. And most of the killing, I'm sad to say, most of the Indians that were killing the white men had never been offended by a white man. And most of the white people killing the Indians had never been offended by an Indian. But you see, that's the way with war. The way with war is always that the innocent gets sucked in. It's a big deal going over here in Bosnia and Herzegovina, you know, about poor innocent people dying. War always kills innocent people. You don't have war, but what innocent people die. And somebody said, well, we need... It's kind of funny now they want to limit the warfare. Well, you talk about absurd. Mankind grows more and more insane every day. You want to get that thing? Get it over with in a hurry. I mean, if you want the bloodshed to stop, let the whatever it is, the Croats or the Muslims or whoever, let them take it. You say, well, people are going to die. People are going to die anyway. If you're not going to stop it, get it over with. I mean, America can't decide what's going to happen, what's not going to happen. But these Indians decided. And they began to attack. They began to attack settlers. They began to steal children. And in several places, ladies were taken away. And I'll tell you what happened. These people who were colonists and had been enjoying the good life, all at once were compelled to a life that wasn't so good anymore. And if you want to pray for revival, and boy, there's been a lot of prayer for revival in the last 10 years in America. I'll tell you what's going to happen. The bottom's going to drop out. And it looks like we might be getting ready to have answered our prayers. It looks like you may have people shot down in the streets of America. You may have homes raided. You may have children taken away from parents. You may have all of that in the next 6 months. And you say, isn't that terrible? How could God do? That's what you've been asking for. You want revival or not? You know, you don't have revival when it gets so good that everybody just says, well, now let's ask God to be part of all this. I tell you what happens is when people start dying and people start bleeding and people start losing family members, they get on their face before God and they say, oh, God, forgive me. And that's where revival comes from. These settlers had the good life taken away from them. And as they did, they began to pray. First, they did not recognize this as a blow from the hand of God. But as things began to move on and the raids began to increase and the number of dead began to multiply, the settlers began to realize God is doing something here. And they began to try and find out what was going on. As a matter of fact, in Sudbury, when Sudbury was attacked by the Indians, it was not the original town that people sought to attack. It's Sudbury, Connecticut. Maybe you've been there. But they had not planned to attack Sudbury. They had planned to march on and to attack Concord. That had been the city that the Indians had devised the plan against. And they were going to march there. However, again, as it was with the story that Winthrop gave, God intervened time and time again in a miraculous way. Here's what they said when they were prepared to go against Concord. There was one man in town who was the preacher in the church at Concord. His name was Edward Bulkley. And the Indians knew about Edward Bulkley. And when they found out who was there, they said, "We," this is a quote, I'm not just speaking in kindergarten English here, "we no prosper if we burn Concord." The Great Spirit loved that people. He tell us not to go there. They have a great man there. He great pray. And the Indians didn't attack Concord. You see, God, I'm glad God supervises all of this. And that's the only hope you've got, is God's still in charge of everything, and God's in control of everything, and yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Why? Thou art with me. God's in control. God was in control here. I read another account of a pastor's wife who was taken by the Indians, and for 11 weeks and 4 days, she was in captivity of the Indians. And the Indians never touched her. The Indians never bothered her. And after 11 weeks, they turned her loose. That was unheard of. But she prayed consistently for those Indians, and people were praying for her. God will teach you how to pray, see. God will put you in praying position. And sometimes, you know, when He knocks you down on your face and knocks you down to your knees, you pray while I'm here. And so the American colonists began to learn how to pray. In all of this, God's moving. God's dealing in the lives of the colonists. God is preparing them. You know, God takes even our problems and uses our problems to bring about our good. The one verse we tend to regulate to good times is the verse that says, "And we know that all things work together for good." We always believe that when we get a better job, when we get a raise, when we get a new car, we get a new house. But I want you to know, a trip down to the graveyard works together for good. A trip down to the hospital works together for good. All things work together for good. And even in the darkest of the times in your life, if you look back now, you can see where God was working in your life. I mean, you may have been flat on your face. You may have been despondent of life itself. And God was judging you. But even in that judgment, He was working to prepare you for something. He's bringing about good. And that was the case in the lives of these pilgrims and settlers, because God was preparing them for something that would take place 100 years into the future. What's going to take place 100 years into the future from 1675 and 1676? I'll tell you what's going to take place: the American Revolution. What's going to happen in the American Revolution? I'll tell you what will happen in the American Revolution. The American colonists will be outnumbered sometimes as many as 40-1 by British troops, trained troops. And what happened? The Americans won. How did they win? They won because they fought in an unconventional manner. You know where they learned that unconventional manner? Right here fighting against King Philip. You see, Indians like to ambush. Indians like to fight from fortified positions. Indians like to fight from forests. They're what we call early guerrilla fighters. And they wrote the book on it. And what happened is all these pilgrims, I mean, it was, you read account after account of slaughter where the Indians would feign an attack and they would pretend like the pilgrims were defeating them, and they would run back into the woods, and here'd come 12 or 15 pilgrim men out the gates, you know, chasing these Indians, and the Indians would butcher them right there in front of the fort. They were just trying to get them out. The Indians were masters of guerrilla warfare. But you see, there had been some Christians who had some Indians who had been saved, and they were Christians. And for a long time, some of these Indians were interred in a camp because the white man wouldn't trust them. But more and more, as time went by, these Indians began to be trusted, and the white man began to allow them into the battles. And when they found out how well the Indians fought against the Indians became the scouts and eventually trained the Americans how to fight the Indians. And the Indians taught the white man, they had all, Squanto, remember, had taught them how to hunt. Squanto had taught them how to fish. Squanto had taught them how to plant crops. Squanto had taught them how to build houses. The white man was responsible for the goodness of the Indian in his existence in the first place. And now the Indian taught him something else. The Indian taught him how to fight Indians. He never would have survived had it not been for the Indians teaching him how to fight the Indians. But he survived. And they taught the white man how to fight. And as the thing transpired, the American people began to turn more and more to themselves and began to try and find out what was wrong with themselves. Because, listen, when you've lost an infant, when you've lost a husband or a wife, there is an immediate question. People say, well, I'm an atheist and don't believe in God. You just wait till you lose a husband or a wife or a child. And you look up into the face of the God you don't even believe exists and ask why. And these settlers began to look toward heaven and they began to ask why. And when they asked why, the pulpits resounded with the answer. The pulpits, you had men like Cotton Mather and his father and some of these men who were preaching in the churches. And they were telling the people, even before this time, if you don't get right with God, His judgment will fall. If you don't get your lives right with God, His mercy is going to come to an end and His wrath is going to be poured out. And these preachers have been preaching this all the way through. And yet now the people began to listen. And they began to realize the reason God has allowed this to happen is because we turned away from God in our moment of prosperity. And they began to turn back again to God. They began to turn their faces again. In 1676, a fellow by the name of Peter Folger wrote a poem. I'll read it to you. He says, if we then truly turn to God, He will remove His ire and will forthwith take His rod and cast it in the fire. Let us then search what is the sin that God doth punish for, and when found out, cast it away and ever it abhor. That was a fellow by the name of Peter Folger. He was the grandson of Benjamin Franklin. And I give you an idea of what these people were doing. Back in these days, they had begun to see the handwriting on the wall. They recognized what God was doing. That's what's sad, is with all of the turmoil and all of the strife in America today, people cannot realize that God's behind it all. You know, the answer to America's crime rate is not gun control, it's God's control. And we will not acknowledge that God is in control. You see, we've developed a God today who's everybody's big buddy. Everybody believes in God who is, you know, the typical old white-haired southern gentleman sitting in heaven, sipping on a mint julep, rocking in his rocking chair, watching his crowd down below as though nothing really meant anything. I want you to know God is involved in the affairs of mankind. God is not just a spectator. God's involved. And God has begun to pour His wrath out in this nation. The earthquake that shook Los Angeles, we mentioned a lot here, but I think it's worth, you know, every time our side gets a point, I think we ought to mention it. And that earthquake that shook Los Angeles, you know, and destroyed all that stuff. Did you know that I believe it was the 19 of the largest producers of pornography in America, their headquarters was within 3 miles of the epicenter of that earthquake? Now explain that to me, would you? Just coincidence? I'll tell you what, there have been some people in America praying, saying, God, that stuff's got to stop. And God, we can't do it. We can't do it at the voting booth. We can't do it by protesting. God, You've got to intervene. And God said, okay. And everything falls apart. God's in control. And God has the ability. The pilgrims began, the colonists, the settlers began to turn back to God. And the churches again began to fill up. And when that happened, God began to back off. And the Indian War, you'll find, is kind of interesting. The fellow's name was Captain Benjamin Church, was his name. And August the 26th, 1676, in a battle that the settlers had designed by being trained by their Indian friends and scouts, they feigned defeat in the face of the Indians. And when the Indians pursued the settlers, they had an ambush set for them and totally annihilated the raiding party and killed King Philip himself. And when Philip died, the cause was gone. The Indians disbanded and went back to living the lives they had been living before because the instigator was dead himself. But it was ironic that the settlers used the Indians' own fighting tactics. And they had been taught those by Christian Indians. It's amazing, as I said before, when you come down through here, people say, well, you know, America just kind of fell together. It's kind of an evolutionary thought. America didn't fall together. We're back here. We've gone all the way back to 1400, and we've seen how God again and again and again and again intervened so that America would be ripe and ready for what took place in 1776. God preparing the way. And even in the bad of an Indian uprising, hundreds of people killed. I think here I've got a couple of notes here. At Lancaster, 50 men were executed by the Indians. While people watched, they burned 40 homes to the ground in Groton, Massachusetts. So we're not talking about just a few arrows fired here and there. We're talking in some cases total massacre and people dying, losing children, wives, husbands, and all of those things. And God used that to prepare His people, to bring them back to Himself, and also to teach them how to fight. And years later, when the Redcoats came ashore and the colonists mounted an offensive against them, they took them completely by surprise, and that's how America defeated the British. They fought in an unconventional manner, and they just wiped out the Redcoats. Now then, with the death of Philip, the war is at an end, the churches are packed out, and guess what begins again? Prosperity. And with prosperity comes adversity and difficulty in forgetting God. And toward the end of the 16th century, you have one of the black spots on America's history. Because as the churches filled up and God began to prosper people, the devil began to attack again. And how he had used the Indians the last time around, he no longer used the Indians, but this time he opened up a market for witchcraft in the United States of America. You've read about the trials at Salem. That's in Massachusetts. And these people began to increase the witchcraft. First of all, it was just things like the professing to have the ability to cure a crooked toe. And things along that line that these people professed. And then they were hanging their shingles out so everybody could see it. And they became more and more blatant and boisterous about their ability to do this and do that. And finally, to even cast spells and to bring about the death of an enemy. And you read the account of what took place in the Massachusetts colony, and these people began to flourish. They began to grow and they began to prosper. And when that happened, the Christian people didn't know exactly what to do. They knew what was going on was wrong, but they didn't know how to combat it. And so they decided to combat it by killing and executing those people that professed to have these powers. And they went after them and they hauled them into court. And by the way, you read some of the accounts, and I'm talking about men like Winthrop. I'm not talking about Looney Tunes people here who just made up stories. Winthrop is one of the most appreciated and recognized historians of early America. As a matter of fact, Winthrop believed it was a sin to lie. So if he believed that, there's no reason for Winthrop to tell any lies. As a matter of fact, Winthrop on several occasions, even with the Salem witch trials, he speaks out against what was done at Salem. But in spite of all that, he tells some rather interesting tales about what these people were doing back in Salem. You in America have been kind of isolated from Satan's involvement in an open warfare. I dare say, I'm honest with this, I don't know that I've ever fought Satan personally. Now, I've had some hard times with some demons and some hard times with some demoniac-controlled people, but I don't believe I've ever confronted Satan himself. And I don't believe America's had to deal with Satan for a long time. Why should he? He's got us wrapped up. Satan doesn't have to come over here and attack in America. I'll tell you where he's been working. He's been working over there behind the Iron Curtain. He's been working over there where people have been getting executed and taken away from their families, just like we saw here. But according to Winthrop and Bradford and those people that wrote trustworthy histories, there were some real strange things taking place, like children born that were half beast and half human. People that literally were picked up and thrown into the tops of trees or thrown off of cliffs while other people watched and no one was around them. And things like that, freakish storms and lightning striking churches and burning them to the ground and that type of stuff. And these people honestly got afraid of their enemy. But there's always been a problem for a Christian, particularly when he has power. And that is, do you pray or do you use your power? And these people at this point in time chose to use their power. And they found ways by which they would examine witches. And of course, all the wives' tales came out that a witch, you know, didn't have to breathe. And so they'd put somebody under the water, you know, on the dunking stool. And if indeed they came up and were still alive, they burned them at the stake. Of course, if you were innocent, you drowned. So, you know, if you really wanted to prove your innocence, you drowned. And when they brought you up, you were dead, but they knew that you were not a witch. And some strange thing took place. But let me say this. Do you know there's more said in the average history textbook on a high school level today? There's more said on the witchcraft than there is on the religious beliefs of the pilgrims. And the witches are made out to be, you know, the people that were discriminated against. They were the first minority in America, and the ugly white European Protestants persecuted them mercilessly. And you don't believe that? Go get your history book and read what your kids are learning in school. That's what they're learning. And how terrible it was that these Americans, white Americans, would take these people and burn them at the stake and destroy their lives and see them killed. And I mentioned to you the fact that most people have no idea how many witches were ever burned at Salem. There were 20. 20 witches burned at Salem from the time it began till the time that it ended. 20 of them. And as a matter of fact, of those that were involved, I found it rather interesting, one fellow by the name of Samuel Sewall, S-E-W-A-L-L, who was a progenitor, I'm sure, of my namesake, because that's where my name came from. I don't know if he's related or not. But Samuel Sewall said on the conference, or the judiciary committee that heard the trials and pronounced sentence, and Sewall, less than 3 or 4 years after it was all over, came back and apologized. Now, I'm not saying that made him clear. But I'm saying he came back and apologized and told how God had afflicted his family. He had lost 2 children. And he told how God had afflicted his family because of his involvement with the witch trials at Salem. He professed that he had done it in ignorance and in sinfulness and apologized and repented of his sins and asked God to forgive him and his countrymen to forgive him. Now you say, why is that important? Because at the same time that 20 witches are burned in America, 100,000 witches are burned by the Roman Catholic Church in northern Italy. And you never read a word about that, did you? You never saw a PBS special on that, did you? You never heard about the big mean Catholic Church that attacked a poor little minority in northern Italy. By the way, those witches were people that had a particular worship service. They were called Albigensians and Waldensians. And they were your ancestors here this morning, if you're Bible-believing Christians. 100,000. As a matter of fact, Italy was responsible for the death of somewhere around 1 million people they classified as witches. And the Protestants in America burned 20. Now I'm going to ask you a question. When did you read the Vatican's apology? You missed that one, didn't you? What are you saying, preacher? I'm saying the same thing I've said all the way through. You've got revisionists that are writing history now, and they're making the heroes. And they're deciding which side you should be on. And so they're telling the story slanted so that you come out with their ideals in your mind. And that's what's being taught to our children in public schools. That's why we're teaching American history in a Baptist church. We just want the facts to be known. 20 witches died. 100,000 die in Italy alone. 1734, in the midst of all this, these people now have killed some people they realize probably were innocent. I don't know, they may have killed a witch or two. I don't believe all 20 of those people were witches. I think what you were dealing there is a mob mentality. And a mob mentality, when everything falls apart and the trouble is hot and heavy, people get killed. I said before, any war knows the death of innocents. But these people at Salem realized what they had done. And they came back and apologized and repented and came before the church and asked God to forgive them. And when they did that again, they turned back to God. And what took place on the heels of that, and listen to me, you need to remember this in history, was the foundation for what's going to take place in American history. When this next period of time is over with, America is an independent, sovereign nation. You say, where does it begin? It begins in 1734. In 1734, you have a period in American history known as the Great Awakening. And you're not find any reference to that in any history book taught in any public school in America. You say, what was the Great Awakening? The Great Awakening was a turning back to God by the American people and some of the greatest revivals that ever shook this world. Not just America, but England, France, the European continent. I mean great, great revivals. And you're not going to read anything about it. One of the fellows who saw things began in Northampton, Massachusetts, is what they'll tell you. The Great Awakening began in Northampton, Massachusetts, began in the pulpit of a man by the name of Jonathan Edwards. And Jonathan Edwards, preaching in Northampton, Massachusetts, saw God send a revival, the likes of which, listen, even as a preacher, I sit and read accounts and say, God, how in the world wish you'd do that again? Jonathan Edwards was not a great orator. He was not a vibrant preacher. Matter of fact, you people will be amazed to know most of the preachers back here are about as dry as cracker juice. And I say that not to push my preaching, but to at least to tell you, there are more trained, better preachers in America today than there ever have been in this world. You got the best preaching that's ever been done being done today. Preaching has become an art, and it's become a thing that a student aspires to. And I'm not saying the problem is we've got all this great preaching and God's not doing anything. You see, we're learning the lesson that all is vain unless the Spirit of the Holy One come down. And these men, I was going to read it to you this morning. I don't have enough time. I've got Jonathan Edwards' sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And a little bit of story there about that. But Edwards wrote this sermon out word for word onto a manuscript. And when he went to his pulpit, he read it. How would you like it this morning if I got up and read an outline? And Edwards just got up and read this sermon to his people as he did hundreds of times before. But something had happened in Edwards' life. Edward had begun to pray in earnest that God would do something for his people. And he prayed and he prayed and he prayed and he prayed. And on this particular morning, unlike every other morning, although he came to the pulpit the same way with the same prepared manuscript, he began to preach. And I shouldn't say in the morning, it was in the evening, began to preach. And when he began to preach, he hadn't scarcely read two or three paragraphs before there was a hush fell across the audience. And people began to weep and began to cry. And as he read that sermon further and further, people began to hold the backs of the pews. Remember, the sermon was Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Sinners began to grab the backs of the pews, and before he was scarcely halfway through with a sermon that's in this book right here, people were crying out unto God from their seat, begging God not to let them drop into hell. And I mean the spires of revival fanned through that church, and then another, and then another, and then another, and then another. And people literally would fall on the streets when these preachers would walk down the street. There are accounts. And the preachers weren't holy men. I'm not trying to give you that. I'm not trying to convey that. But the Spirit of God was moving in America to such an extent that when preachers would walk down the streets, people would collapse at their feet and beg God to save them. No sermon ever preached. Great revivals. You have Jonathan Edwards and you have another fellow by the name of George Whitefield. Those two men probably ought to be some of the most famous names to the American people. George Whitefield was a personal friend of Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, I do not believe, ever got saved. I do not believe he was a saved man. But he remarked time and time again at the godliness and the holiness of a George Whitefield. He appreciated him. He was his friend. When no one else would stand by Whitefield, Franklin would. It's an amazing thing. Back in those days, even lost people had more character than Christians do today. But Whitefield began in England about the same time Edwards was beginning here in America. George Whitefield was ordained March the 25th, 1739. and 1736. And he began preaching. The first three places he preached was Bath, Bristol, and Gloucester, England. And when he finished preaching in each one of those towns, they had revival they had never known the likes of before. I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands and thousands of conversions. We're not talking a little Billy Graham, you know, skipping the park crusade where they say everybody come forward and you watch 1,000 people go forward. They just don't tell you that 985 of them are workers hired to work with a Billy Graham campaign in order to ensure people go forward. But I'm talking about places where when the revival left, they closed up bars and converted them to churches. They opened up the prisons because they didn't need them anymore. I'm talking about revivals where the whole complex or the complexion of the community was changed for years and years and years. Whitfield left England and came to the United States to Georgia, where Oglethorpe had started a colony down there. You see, Oglethorpe started a colony in Georgia. You may not be aware of this, but he took people out of debtors' prisons in England. He saw people in England being put in prison because they couldn't pay their debts, and he thought there has to be a better way. And so he got the king to open up those prisons, and those people that settled in Georgia were let out of debtors' prisons. They were given an opportunity to work off their debts and to buy their own lands. And Whitfield went down to Georgia. It was also called a Baptist colony because by the time Whitfield got done, thousands and thousands and thousands of people had gotten saved. As a matter of fact, he returned then to England and went back and began to preach again in Bristol. And when he went back to England, he found out that the churches in England had closed their doors. They would not allow him back in again. He was one of these reactionary types. Remember, you still have the Anglican Church in England. And they were not about to have one of these rowdy preachers in one of their polished, refined Anglican churches. And so Edwards defined and established something that really probably never would have happened, and that was a return to open-air meetings. Whitfield said, if they won't let me preach in the church, then I'll preach in the streets. And Whitfield went out and started preaching in the streets. You know what he did? He went to a place where they had the old coal mines over in Bristol. And the colliers that worked in those coal mines were reputed to be some of the, you talk about the dregs of society. One fellow said that even the sailors stayed away from the colliers. And we're talking about the dregs of society. And Whitfield one day found a little mound of clay outside one of those mining shafts. And as the colliers came up in their blackened clothes and filthy faces and hands, Whitfield began to preach to them. And he preached not for an hour, but for 2 hours. And they stood there and listened to him preach. And he gave the account of how after about 2 hours, he began to see little white trails forming down their cheeks as those grown men began to weep. And the next day, there were several hundred more people that stopped to hear him preach. The next day, several hundred more assembled to hear him preach. And by then, the archbishop was getting a little upset. And so he called Whitfield in and forbade Whitfield to preach anywhere in Bristol anymore. And so Whitfield, being the good fellow that he was, went back the next day and preached again on the street. And by this time, some of the press had gotten a hold of him being forbidden to preach and went and counted, and they counted over 23,000 people that stood outside to hear George Whitfield preach. When's the last time you reckon they had a street meeting here in town where 23,000 people gathered around to hear a guy preach? I'll tell you what happened. God was moving and people were being saved. Franklin, one time, I believe it was in Philadelphia. Whitfield was preaching on the street and Franklin paced off in the street. He walked as far away as he could and still hear Whitfield preaching clearly and audibly. And then he went back to his little shop. You see, Franklin was a philosopher and a mathematician. Went back to his shop and he took that area and mapped it out. And Franklin said this, if that area had been open air, well over 30 to 40,000 people could have clearly heard Whitfield preach without a microphone. God was moving in America, in England, and in the rest of the world. It's called the Great Awakening. All right, let's take a break this morning. We'll be back next week.